You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Alicia Goranson. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robinson.
And I'm Doc Coleman, filling in for Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is an opportunity for us to take some time with our astonishing guest hosts and explore their craft, trying to understand a little more about how they do what they do, how they see their world, and how they approach the task of bringing stories and characters to life.
That's awesome. I love that. The digging into the mojo of the creative mind. Doc, thank you so much, man, for stepping in, filling in for the vacationing Brian Humphrey. I really appreciate it, bud.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Yeah.
One more step on my podcast domination of the world.
See, and I have an esteemed position in that ultimate domination. Please remember this when you are our future overlord, won't you?
Indeed.
Well, Doc, let's roll into this episode of 20 Minutes With, and allow me to introduce you to our esteemed guest host for this episode.
That would be excellent. That would really improve the 20 Minutes With.
I think so. Let's by all means do that. Doc, our guest host is... I continue to be amazed at the diversity and the sheer scope and spectrum of the creative spirit that is out there in the world. Our guest host is actually the reincarnation of Scheherazade, and embodies all 10 muses. Now, I know you thought there were only 9. There's actually 10, and she is the vessel for all 10.
The 10th one being the muse of podcasting, of course.
That must be... I think Plato might have something to say about that, but sure, let's roll with that. I like that. She is a Boston author and playwright who reads all across the country. Her novel, Supervillains, published by Suspect Thought Press, was a 2006 Lambda Literary Award finalist and the winner of the 2003 Project Queerlit competition. She also has two other novels out there, Provincetown Ho and War of the Foxes. Her writing has appeared in anthologies such as Pinned Down by Pronouns, Best Lesbian Erotica 2007, and in Other Magazine. She also, and you'll love this, Doc, she also is richly immersed in the field of audio drama.
Excellent.
She's written, this is awesome, Doctor Who and the Starship of Madness.
Okay, I love her already.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, audio fanfic with Doctor Who, oh hell yeah. Also, The Sirens of War and The War of the Worlds, The Mob versus the Martians and The Fall of Boston. Which
excellent.
which she co-wrote with Neil Marsh. Probably her best known piece is The Mask of Inanna, which is a 2012 finalist for Best Speculative Fiction Audio Drama Long Form with the Parsec Awards. The Post-Meridian radio players perform her plays annually at their Tomes of Terror Halloween shows.
Wow.
And Charlie Jane Anders, editor at io9.com. And if you don't know what io9 is,
you need to check it out right after the podcast.
Exactly.
I-09.
It's I-O, isn't it?
I-O. io9.com.
Right, yes. It is geek, nerd, science, spec, fic, awesomeness. Charlie says of our guest host, her superpowers include searing vision, a powerful voice, and the ability to leap over genre boundaries, which is probably some of the highest praise any author or writer can garner in this business. So, friends, please welcome to the Skype line and to the big chair at the Round Table Podcast, our guest host for this episode of 20 Minutes With, Alicia Goranson. Alicia, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us here at the Roundtable. We appreciate it.
Hello, my esteemed fans. I only hope to be worthy of you for this particular jaunt through the mind of fiction.
Oh, you are a drama queen, aren't you?
No, actually, I'm the person in the back of the room who nobody suspects.
Oh, really? That makes you even more dangerous.
Dangerous? Who says I'm dangerous? Who's been telling such things?
Oh, tales.
Surely there are no survivors to tell such tales.
That's right, exactly.
I would hope so, indeed, yes. Hello, everybody. I am Alicia E. Goranson. I just want to say I am not Alicia L. Goranson, who you may be familiar with from Roseanne and Boys Don't Cry. I have a different middle name, and so that makes me different.
Exactly. And you pursue a very different craft from that other Goranson. So, and let's talk about that craft. I'm going to hit the timer for our 20 minutes with here, and let's delve into your creative process, Alicia. Now, first and foremost, I want to talk a little bit about supervillains, because this touches on, it's not just about the superhero genre, which has really been developing a broad following and a lot of attention in recent times. But you really went a different direction with that. It actually became something of a deconstruction of the superhero and the comic vibe. And I was wondering if you could speak just a little bit about your motivation behind that and how you approach that process in terms of presentation, in terms of character development and execution.
Yeah, the main thing I was trying to do with it, the initial inspiration was I always saw transgendered people as being portrayed as villains in the media. And so like, okay, hey, here you go. Here's a whole story in which they really are portrayed as the villains, even though they don't want to be. They are pushed into these situations in which they are forced to act villainous in order to survive. And I just wanted to have a lot of fun with playing around with those kind of deconstructions. It was also an early work of mine, so I was still getting a little, I was still working on characterization at the time, but a lot of people have said that they really responded to the main characters who are considered the villains, the Scooby Gang of quote-unquote villains.
Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered about characterization in there? You mentioned that you were still working it through. What processes were you working through, and what did you discover about that?
My biggest problem was the quote-unquote superheroes. They were mostly based on two people I hadn't spoken with for a long time, and so I didn't have I didn't have them down. I wasn't able to get into their heads. They kind of did things for set pieces and weren't really characters in and of themselves, unlike the other folks, Devin and Marky and everybody, who are all pretty much real people who I knew, and I just was taking their brains and putting them into all these situations. I kind of think of it you put all the characters into a glass bottle and you shake it up and then you see what happens. It's unfortunate that I wasn't able to give the Noonans a better role at the time, but one of the things I learned is that for me, not doesn't work for everybody, but for myself, always start with somebody you know. Always start with a person that I know. See if you can get in their heads, talk to them, call them on the phone, be able to exploit them, be able to extract the goodness within them, the essential characterness within them, something that you come away from a conversation with them thinking, I like this about this person, or I don't like this about this person, and just replicate it. The way that I normally work is that I tend to create conversations between people who I know in my head. Actually, I sometimes do it while I'm talking to them. I kind of, you know, create a mental map of what this person's going to be like and what this person's going to say to me, so that I'm able to respond to them a little quicker. And that's kind of what I'm doing in my writing. I'm just taking that same sort of interconnectedness, that the same sort of simulation. I consider the works mostly like simulations, and that after a while, I'm able to figure out what works and what doesn't. And what doesn't work is when you read something afterwards and you say, this doesn't flow. This doesn't come out of the tongue. This doesn't, and that's why some of the reasons that I think that audio drama was a natural progression, because I'm always thinking about how would this sound aloud, and I wasn't thinking about that as much when I was first starting out.
Okay, and we are so going to hit the audio drama thing a little bit later in this 20 minutes with, but I wanted to ask: do you do a lot of side writing, free writing? When you're working on a literary project, a novel or a short story, Do you write things that you know are not ever going to appear in the story to help explore the voice or the tone of the characters or the piece? Or do you just dive right in and are writing always on task with the book at hand?
It really depends on the project. A lot of the cases, yes, absolutely. There's going to be sitting down with a couple characters and seeing where they go. But I find that that isn't as useful to me as there is if I put two characters in a situation in which they have plot and agency. Just having two people sit down and talk to me doesn't provide enough stimulation in the characters' own heads to be able to talk. It's like sitting down two strange people on a bus somewhere. Most likely they're not going to talk to each other, and if they are, it's going to be of something very tertiary. So I find that what I like to do is I like to pre-write scenes. I like to go into, I know this scene is going to happen, and so I test it out. I know this scene is going to happen, so I test it out a little bit. And basically I want to make sure that the character at least has somewhere to breathe, and I wait for them to do something I don't expect. And that's very important. That's when you know that you've actually hit something about your own realization about the character, that they're able to live in your head like a little AI, and they can do their own thing and have their own quirks.
See, now I've heard, and Doc, you and I both have heard this from writers. There's two camps in that field of thought. One is, these are your characters. They do what you want them to do. And then there's that other camp, and Doc, I'm pretty sure you're part of this camp too, where you just kind of let the characters go, and you can be surprised by them.
Oh, yeah. I find for myself, when I'm working on a story, I tend to start off with a scene that I have to write in order to get into the atmosphere of the setting. And usually what ends up happening is I end up cutting that scene because the scene is crap. But it's kind of necessary to get myself into the right atmosphere for everything that follows.
Sure, sure. So, Alicia, I'm curious, how do you foster that, do you think? I mean, I've experienced the same thing where a character suddenly blurts out something that was not in my head, and yet it still occurs. Where does that come from? I mean, clearly these are not spiritual beings that are lurking tangibly over our shoulder, whispering in our ears, or maybe they are, I don't know. What do you think that discovery, that sudden inspiration that comes out of nowhere, where does that come from?
It's the collective unconscious or something that could be described as such. Basically, there's a lot more going on in your head than you are tangibly able to access. There's a great deal of low-level programming that's going on that you really need to be able to focus and do all kinds of meditative techniques in order to realize. And at some point, I mean, the way that I work is, as I said in the pre-show, all writing is like jazz. You just play it, and you just as it happens, you just accept it and just go with it. And that makes it for a much more organic experience, especially my own writing itself is very different than others because I'm trying to get at something. I'm trying to do something that's a lot more realistic. I'm trying to, I mean, obviously it's very stylized, but at the same time, I try to get some real life banter. I don't go for the clever quip. I go for the reaction. I go for the ow when you poke somebody. So it's two people poking each other. Ow, ow, ow. But there's so many different ways you can say ow when the two people are poking each other. That's primarily what it is I'm going for. And you have to trust yourself. This is not something you can do today. This is not something you got to do this for years, in my case, before you're able to trust yourself and be able to play several characters in your head and trust yourself to let them do what they're going to do. While at the same time, I find it incredibly necessary for them to have some kind of plot and agency to live in. So they are actors. They are on a stage and X, Y, and Z needs to happen. But they get to make a decision.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Alicia Goranson after this brief promotional break.
Do you like movies? Well, let me make you an offer that you can't refuse. Have you ever found yourself standing at the local Cineplex with that smell of freshly buttered popcorn wafting through your nostrils, wondering if that new Hugh Jackman movie is really worth your time? Or have you ever lamented about that time you spent scouring the vast expanse of the internet for movie and DVD release dates when, let's be honest, you'd rather be leveling up your Troll Hunter, working on the Great American Novel, or even watching kitten videos? Oh yes, I said kitten videos. I will do the work for you. All I ask is 15 to 30 minutes of your time every Tuesday. My name is Michael Faulkner, and every Tuesday is showtime at the weekly Podioplex, your audio guide to what's new at the box office, how the top 10 fared over the weekend, and what's coming to your home theater on DVD and Blu-ray. You can find the weekly Podioplex on the Chronic Rift Network at www.chronicrift.com, along with a plethora of other podcasts that explore the culture in pop culture. The weekly Podioplex, brought to you by the Chronic Rift. Thanks for listening. We'll see you at the theater.
That's a wrap!
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Alicia Goranson.
I just wanted to comment that when the characters start doing things you're not expecting, that's usually a sign that you're doing a good job of characterizing them, because real people do things you don't expect.
Sure.
If they always do exactly what you wanted them to do, then there's the danger of your characters coming off as sock puppets.
Right. Right. Two-dimensional.
Now, of course, there are some people who are just that good at studies of human nature that they can predict things, and they usually end up going into politics and becoming evil dictators. But
I also want to point out that good characterization is not necessary for every story. There are many stories. There are particularly a lot of genre type stuff in which you do not want a character to be fully fleshed out, which you do not want a character to behave outside the bounds of the story, where the fascination is not in watching the characters, you know, behave as regular people, but behave as archetypes going through an established plot and an established cycle, which is far more interesting. I mentioned to you in the email, I feel like all writing is fetish, and you can have, you know, your plot fetish, your character fetish, your point of view fetish, you know, description fetish, that's a Tolkien, you know, dialogue, setting, pacing, voice, etc. And whatever it is that you're interested in communicating to a reader, that's what your focus can be on. For example, in The Mask of Inanna, every episode there is a little mini-sode, which is like an old-time radio show called After Dark, and they're the characters in there. They're not people. They don't act like regular people. No, they go through their little motions, and I mean, I consider them far more intellectual puzzles than anything, but the fact is that it does, because they have bad characterization, does not make the story any less, you know, interesting or compelling to somebody. So I just want to point out that, you know, we don't focus on everything. Focus on what you're interested in. Focus on the fetish.
I hadn't really considered that, but you're right. We tend to get wrapped up in we must have fully fleshed and realized characters, yada yada. But you're right.
I wouldn't say fully. I would just say sufficiently.
Sufficiently, there you go, to serve the story that's being told.
See, now I do believe in archetypes, but I don't want people look at my characters and say, oh, that's this archetype. I want them to look at it and say, oh, that's the person that this archetype comes from. Okay.
An expression of that, one of the many expressions of that archetype.
Yeah, that way they can, they see the archetype, but they also, there's room for the character to do things which are surprising.
Sure. Sure.
That's me.
Right. And that's what you like. But in a lot of cases, a lot of, for example, there's a lot of, you know, for example, Harry Potter fan fiction in which the focus is not on, you know, the characters being anything but the archetypes that they've been set up as.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely.
That people really want to. It's like I know I want to see X, Y, and Z, you know, happen to, you know, standard archetype, whatever. And it's just up to you as an author to either be true to yourself or write what it is that you feel that the reader wants to see. And it depends a lot on whether you're getting paid or not.
Yeah, there's always that. Alicia, in one of your interviews, you had come out as a strong advocate of not writing alone necessarily, but engaging in a broader community through the writing process. And I wondered if you could explain a little bit, what do you see the benefit of that approach or that strategy towards your writing. What does that bring you as a writer, and how do you maximize those gains during that process?
First of all, it gives you a deadline. It avoids the Douglas Adams trap of, I love deadlines, I love the whooshing sound they make as they pass by. When you're working with somebody, you've got to say, okay, I'm going to get this to you this month, I'm going to get this to you this month, and it gets some impetus in you to sit down and make a time in your schedule to do this, because let's face it, you know, we're busy people, and we're, a lot of cases, we're broken people, and we need something else in our heads to keep us, you know, focused on the task at hand and not letting all the other crap in our lives overwhelm you. The second thing is that it gives you something, someone to aspire to. As I was saying, all writing is fetish, and gives you a reader to aspire to. It's like you say to yourself, I need, I know this person likes X, Y, and Z, and so I'm going to floor them. I'm going to do this, and this is going to go, and I'm going to do this, and they're going to be, you know, so it's, I want it to be, it gives you a chance to be, it's like performing, a musician performing in front of a mic in your own studio and performing in front of a crowd.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. And let's go ahead and evolve through that to, speaking of audiences and playing, playing specifically to them, your work as a playwright and as an audio dramatist, Doc and I are both avid fans of not just the full cast or narrated form, but also the full-on audio dramas, and that's a lot of work, first and foremost, but it's also a very different creative process from novel to script, especially a full cast or a full audio script, rather than just an adapted novel for podcasting or for serialization as an audio audio production. Could you speak a little bit about what you found those distinctions to be, and what delights do you find as you compare one to the other?
Okay. So an audio drama, from my own perspective, you got to set it up like a TV show. You have to plan each scene. You have to know where all where everything is in the room. You need to know where the actors are going to be walking. You need to know what they're going to be touching. If there's anything important, you either need to hear it or they need to make a comment about it. And unfortunately, that's not natural speech, so you've just got to grin and bear it and have the person say, oh, this purple rock is quite interesting. It's completely different from writing a novel, in which you are working with flow, the flow of words, the beauty of words on a page. You need to be able to do a lot more with ideas. You need to be able to, when you go deep in a novel in terms of themes, concepts, etc., you know, every sentence needs to tie into that somehow. Every page needs to pull you in a way that you automatically get pulled in when dealing with audio or video. So when I'm talking about something that's on a page, when I'm writing, I want to get into some of the larger themes of the show. I want to start out with some character's motivation, described in the way that they are interacting with environment they're touching, or they're thinking, or they're acting. There's a lot more potential for fleshing out a world, actually, I think, in writing than in audio.
Okay.
I think the biggest difference between writing for the page and for audio drama is direction. I think that you have a different set of priorities depending on what it is, how the reader is experiencing the story. You're going to tell something, read the novelizations of movies. You'll be able to see the fact that the novel has to, it can't assume a lot of things which are assumed on the big screen. And the big screen assumes a lot of things that can be just pointed out in the novel. Sure. Novels tend to have to be a lot fleshier. You got to put a lot more words into it.
Do you have a preference? Do you have a preference, one or the other?
At this point, there's just been a lot more research into the novel that I tend to like those more. But at the same time, we're getting there with audio drama, and my own personal preferences are for very broken characters. For example, I like works such as Scanner Darkly, because those are real people.
Yeah,
as I, you know, those are real people in Philip K. Dick's house, you know, on all kinds of drugs, all kinds of broken brokenness in the head. It would be more likely that a romance or a mainstream novel would have a situation that would be broken if everybody was honest with each other.
Right.
And so that's kind of what I write for. I write for assuming everybody's being honest with each other, assuming that every person's personal reality is being reflected as true. Those personal realities may clash, you know, because you may have somebody who's really hyper and somebody who's really introverted. And so then you get your odd couple situations. And those sorts of things are absolutely fascinating to me. I love things like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and whatnot.
Definitely a surreal experience. Alicia, as you look forward in your career as a writer, as an author, as a playwright, what are you striving for at this point, you know, in terms of your craft, in terms of the stories that you want to tell? What is your current objective in that, and how are you working to achieve that?
I see an utter wasteland in terms of all of the characters and all the people that I know, who I love very, very much. I see a massive cultural wasteland in terms of writing that speaks to them, in terms of GLBT people, specifically queer hippie types who are into like Bruce Serling and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Broken people, autistic people. I want to make heroes for them all. I want to make heroes for trans people. I want to make just aspirational fiction. And I don't want to dull it down any. I don't want to dumb it. I want to tell it real and honest and show how, you know, as we are, as broken and sometimes hard to deal with, we're still wonderful, radiant, vibrant people who can provide all kinds of wonder and joy to the worlds that they live in. And also, I want to show them taking down the man.
Because the man does need to be taken down. Ain't no doubt about that. So how are you going to pursue that?
Say what? It's part of the aspiration to be able to show that you have power over the authority that generally has a lot of power over you.
Okay. How are you pursuing that? What do you anticipate for how you can expand and enrich that field of creativity?
With the supervillains, I pretty much did it. Though, you know, as I said, a very early start with trans people. You know, the villains of the story, Bit and Devin, they're trans, and they ultimately went out. I'm currently working on a project that's doing that for autistic people, which we may talk about another time.
Absolutely.
I don't want to reveal too much at this point because I'm still writing it.
okay.
And for example, for the furry community, I was working on the War of the Foxes, which is going into a lot of the realistic identity issues that a lot of people have, combined with some of the spirituality that people feel is a good metaphor for the sort of identity crises that they have. I wanted to go into, I also worked on another autistic story called The Barkies, which you can probably find online.
Okay. Yeah, right. On your website. And what is your website?
Alicia-Goranson.com.
Ding! Awesome. Very cool. Alicia, there's more to discuss because we just tapped the whole furry thing, and that's something I've always been intrigued about, but we'll have to defer that to another time because
we are way out of time.
We are. The clock has wound down. It mooned me on the way out the door, so we're going to have to wrap this up. But Alicia, thank you so much for sharing your insights and perspectives. I know there was one or two epiphany moments in there for me, and we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Right back at you, Dave. Thank you so much, guys.
Awesome. Doc, any observations or closing comments about today's 20 minutes?
There's just so much there to think over, but I don't know. It's it really makes me want to take some time to go out and go right.
and in the true spirit of the Humphreyism that is, yes, absolutely, yes. Go right.
That's right, Doc. Go out and make heroes for your people. My God, do we need it?
Yes. Yep. That absolutely. Yeah. Go write heroes. Go find heroes. Friends, you're our hero, just so you know, because you hit that play button. And we are deeply grateful every time you do. Thank you so much for joining us. Do return in a few days. We'll have Alicia back workshopping a very cool alien mystery tale. But until then, if you're feeling the love for the round table, the best thing you can do is spread the word. Let folks know about them. If you see one of our tweets up there, retweet that bad boy, because retweets are like sweet, sweet food for us. Swing out to the iTunes site. Give us a rating. Give us a review. There's going to be room for comments on the post at our website, www.roundtablepodcast.com. And generally, as Doc said, and as Brian always says, go right. Go look for awesomeness, because you find what you're looking for. We'll see you guys in a couple of days. Until then, be cool, stay frosty, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.